Hello and welcome to this bonus episode of the EMG Health Podcast. Today, I'm excited to share that we'll be diving into the abundant and complex topic of oral contraception. Professor Christina Gemzell-Danielson, Dr. Diana Mansour, and Professor Jonathan Dufis are the invited experts who will discuss the history of combined oral contraceptives, the impact of the pandemic on access, the risks associated with contraception, and share some data on a recently introduced oral contraceptive containing estetrol and dispirinone. This episode has been sponsored by Gedeon Richter. The discussion represents the opinion of the speakers and was not influenced by Gedeon Richter. The information contained in this podcast is solely for healthcare professionals and is not for an audience without the relevant education. It is not intended as and shall not be understood or construed as medical or health advice. And now, I would like to give the floor to our speakers.
Welcome, everyone. Welcome, Christina, Diana. I think we are here to discuss about the new oral contraceptive, and we know that that when oral contraceptive became generally available during the early 60s, their use rapidly increased, and I think that in 2019 it was estimated that over 150 million women were using the pill worldwide. So with such many subjects taking this medicine, even a small increase in risk of serious side effects affects the lives of many women. And this is exactly, in fact, what we faced this year with the so-called, you know, vaccine-induced thrombotic thrombocytopenia, also named VITT. So the presenting feature of this condition is the formation of a clot in the brain. And for me, this reminds us of the famous pill scare that occurred in the 90s. And now we see many women questioning on this risk and on the concomitant intake of the pill. I think it is very important that discussion comparing the risk of blood clots associated with the AstraZeneca COVID-19 vaccine with those associated with the contraceptive pill do not pave the way to a repeat of the pill scare that occurred in the 90s, which led, I think, to a significant increase in unplanned pregnancies. So Diana, I know that you have an active role in the Faculty of Sexual and Reproductive Healthcare. So can you tell us what is the position and the recommendation of the FSRH on this situation?
You're absolutely right, Jonathan. It's interesting that women who choose combined hormonal contraception now are very much aware of very small potential risks in relation to venous thromboembolism. And of course, we've been well aware of the risk for VTE that's been associated with the COVID infection, as well as vaccination. And many women came to see us and actually said, well, what should we do? You know, if we get COVID, should we stop our pill? If we go for vaccination, should we actually stop our pill? And of course, the answer is, well, we just didn't know at that stage. We produced a faculty guidance sheet that came out in December of last year, based on not a lot of evidence, I have to say, but there were experts sitting around a table. And we initially decided that where women were asymptomatic with COVID and they were taking, say, a combined hormonal contraceptive, they could carry on using that pill. They may wish to change to, say, a progesterone-only pill, but there was no real need. We then talked about women who were severely unwell with COVID, so those that were in hospital, and obviously their mobility was reduced. They may even have been ventilated. And, of course, at that stage, we said, from what we knew, it would probably be good guidance that they stop their pill. And when they were discharged from hospital, we would prescribe them a progesterone-only pill. And then, of course, you've got the symptomatic women who are at home, and should they or should they not change their method of contraception? And I think we decided it depended on the severity and whether they were quite immobile, whether perhaps we should advise them to use a progesterone-only pill. And lastly, we then looked at vaccination, and we didn't see, obviously, the problems with the Pfizer vaccine, and all our under 40s were actually given a Pfizer vaccine. But we did talk about those that might have been on an AstraZeneca or going for an AstraZeneca vaccination. And overall, we knew that the actual incidence was so low, and it was a different mechanism, that as long as they had no contraindications to continuing to take the combined hormonal contraception, they continued to take it even when they had their vaccinations. But it's been a very interesting time for all of us. I don't know, Christina, how you feel about all of this.
Yes, so I think it is really important with information, because of course pill users, they can just, if they're worried, we've seen that before, then they just stop using the pill and they may risk a pregnancy, which would put them into much worse situation. So I think it's good with information that's needed. And it's also good to inform. There are so many myths around the pills or combined hormonal contraception and side effects. At the same time, issues around venous thromboembolism, there are also a lot of incorrect information. So, I mean, there is a belief that women who are not on the pill would not get a VT, which is, of course, incorrect. And that we will not be aware of this side effect, which is also incorrect. I mean, it's been known for since the 60s that the combined hormonal pill is associated with an increased risk for VTE, and we are very well aware of who should not use the pill or combined hormonal method. And of course, that information is extremely important. I think it's also important that, it's very rare that someone would need to stop their hormonal contraception acutely. So there is time to get advice. And another, in Sweden, we are quite reluctant for women to stop the pill, even if they undergo surgery. So we tend to recommend instead that they use anticoagulantia. But of course, that is also a balance. But I think it's extremely important to do a risk-benefit analysis, and also for women not to be afraid and not to just quit the pill, because that may really put them in a much worse situation. And to be aware of this very small risk that we, and that's why contraceptive counseling is so important, because that's something that we really look at in our contraceptive counseling.
Yes, I mean, we've actually seen from last year, it's been estimated that unplanned pregnancy almost doubled, partly due to access problems to services in general practice and in our community, but also the concerns of people taking combined hormonal contraception, which makes up about 3.5 million women in the UK. And we saw a similar sort of increase with the pill scare in the 1990s. So it's getting that message right, isn't it? That we can actually talk to women, we can get the messages across quickly, and they don't lose confidence and they don't feel unsafe with the pills they're taking.
I agree, and I agree. We should learn from history, because we can see it with every pill scare. We can see that women get scared, they quit the pill, and then unplanned, unwanted pregnancy rates increase. So we have actually lessons that we can learn from. And also how important this is, and how important it is to give timely information. And I love the faculty guidelines. I think they are extremely good. But it is important that women also outside of UK can get access to this information.
I also fully agree with you, and I think that it is also important for the physician to clearly understand what is behind the physiopathology behind the risk of VTE in combined oral contraceptives or combined hormonal contraceptive and VTT. For example, the risk of developing a thrombosis after the administration of an adenovirus-based COVID-19 vaccine is clearly not similar to the mechanism observed in women taking the pill. The development of thrombosis in VIT is like the one we can see with heparin-induced thrombocytopenia, and it involves an autoimmune mechanism. So in fact, in subjects with VIT, the body generates IgG antibodies, which are directed against a complex formed by a component of the vaccine. So it can be the virus protein, free DNA, or some excipient. We don't know exactly up to now. And with the platelet 4, which is called PF4. And this complex will then form a neoantigen, which can be recognized by these specific antibodies and in turn activate the platelets. So this is totally different, because what we have with COC, it is a different mechanism. And here it is more based on a kind of resistance towards APC. And there is no, to date, from the data we have, there is no supra-additive effect. So clearly, women should not be afraid about having been vaccinated with an adenovirus-based vaccine, and on the other hand, taking the pill, because the mechanism behind the trigger that can lead to a VTE risk is clearly not the same.
I think that's very reassuring. Thanks, Jonathan. I think, you know, that information hasn't been out there, and we do need to make sure that healthcare professionals take that on board and can explain it simply to women, saying it's a completely different mechanism and you're quite safe to continue to take your combined hormonal contraceptive pill with your booster vaccines, which is what where we're at the moment.
Yes, I agree. Extremely important. And also that there's no use and actually increase the risk if someone makes a short break. I mean, we've had that before, women who think that they need to rest the body, and now if they think that they should make a sudden pill break to reduce the risk, that may actually increase the risk, because when they restart, the effect on the liver and the risk would increase like a new start again. So that's actually potentially an increased risk to do like that.
And of course, if they were to get pregnant, the risk in the last trimester and initially postpartum is far greater than being on a combined hormonal contraceptive pill, which people forget.
Yeah,
that's true. And evidence, we already discussed that, but evidence suggesting that oral contraceptive were associated with an increased risk of VT appear in the 60s. And in fact, this association, this was really the association of an estrogen with a progestogen, which marked the beginning of the combined hormonal contraceptive. And at the beginning, we have to keep in mind that the dose of estrogen was very high. And then to reduce the risk, we subsequently reduce also the dose of estrogen. So starting with dose up to more than 50 micrograms of estrogen. At the beginning, I think it was mestronol, and now it's mainly 18-mean estradiol, even if we have new compound with estradiol and estetrol. And in fact, already at that time, we reduced the dose, but then when we arrived with the 19 crisis, I think the focus was on the progestin, because we did not think that we can change the estrogen. And we have reduced the dose to 30, 20 microgram. And in fact, when we compared already the publication that were released in the literature at that time, we can really see that when we reduce the dose of estrogen, we also reduce the impact on hemostasis. And I think that it is important to keep in mind that the evolution behind COC, and especially the progestogen compound that was found in oral contraceptive, was based on several pharmacomodulations and so on. And the aim was really to be as close as possible to the natural progestin. So the aim was to have an effect which is quite the same as progesterone. But, you know, we divided these pills by different generations, and I'm not sure that it was the good way to do that, because in fact each progestin has its own pharmacodynamic profile, and obviously also I think that it will be very important to have feedback from your clinician perspective, but I don't know what you are thinking about this idea of generations, mainly based on the progestin, because we know that the risk is mainly based on the estrogenic compound. And yes, having this different generation is just a way to focus the risk on the progestin, but I'm not sure that it is really the progestin which is the problem. The problem was mainly probably 18-year estradiol and the dose of 18-year estradiol, but we focused with this generation to say, you know, third, fourth generation are at higher risk of VTE. What is your perspective as a clinician and your feedback from that?
Well, I think what you were saying, Jonathan, I mean, with the progestin, it modulates the activity of the ethanol estradiol. And you're absolutely right. I think we've just focused always after the first 15, 20 years when we reduced the dose of ethanol estradiol, we focused on the progestin and we just focused on the newer ones and call them different generations. I'm almost sure it's something to do with marketing rather than anything else, because if it's a new generation, you think it's going to have new advantages. Rather than actually looking at the structure of the progestins and how they may modulate the ethanol estradiol. And over the years, I've often thought, well, why have we just constantly focused on ethanol estradiol? Why aren't there other estrogens that we could look at? And of course, we do have a couple of products now with estradiol. But again, cycle control has been a bit more difficult. And some of these preparations have been multiphasic as well. So it's been an obstacle for us to actually prescribe something that looks much more like a natural cycle and natural products, which will be very acceptable to women and give regular bleeding.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, this focus on generation, I think that's quite outdated and may also contribute to confusion, because it's important to remember that progestins alone are not associated with an increased risk for VTE. So that's very important, and that's also a frequent misunderstanding that needs to be corrected. And then I think, I mean, what happens, so actually from start, when the pill was developed, estrogen was more contamination, but when it was removed, then the bleeding pattern was not as good as when it was re-added. So that's also interesting to remember from the history. But I think we should switch from focusing on generations to more balancing the estrogenicity and maybe androgen versus anti-androgen effect and so on.
And in fact, I can see in the literature that some groups are tempting to turn them to a chemical classification. But as you mentioned, this is not the holy grail, since among, for example, compounds with similar chemical structure, and I would just say if we look at levonorgestrel and gestadiene, their pharmacodynamic properties may differ on the different steroid receptors. And on a pharmacological point of view, I really like your idea of estrogenicity, because when you have this idea of estrogenicity of the combination, you have the global pharmacodynamic profile of the combination of an estrogen, whatever it can be, ethinyl estradiol, or estetrol, with its associated progestin. And I think especially I'm more involved in hemostasis, you know. And on that sense, it is very interesting to see that the higher the estrogenicity of a combination, and we will discuss that after, the higher the impact you will have on the hemostatic function. And I think we can also capture that with other tests than just SHBG, and we will discuss that later. But no, I think it's really something that we need to put forward to forget about this idea of different generations.
I think it helps also in contraceptive counseling for women who may need a more estrogenic pill or method versus those who would benefit from a method with more androgenic effect. So I think this balance is important to look at.
Yes, I mean, and often these women who do need more of an estrogenic pill may also have their own potential risk factors. I'm thinking classically of those women with elements of PCOS, polycystic ovary syndrome, because they often have hirsutism and acne, but they may have obesity, which is an independent risk factor for venous thromboembolism. And so you have to discuss those potential risks and where you're using it therapeutically versus obviously it being for contraception.
Yeah, so that's one thing we need to remember, that we use hormonal contraceptives not only for contraception but also for treatment actually of various conditions like heavy menstrual bleeding and menstrual related pain and so on.
And regarding the risk of VTE, I think also I would not say a good marker, because we have other markers that can be more interesting to correlate with the risk of VTE, but the concept of estrogenicity can also reflect in some way the risk of VTE. Regarding your clinician point of view and the risk of VTE, what do you think about just these biomarkers compared to what we can have with the post-utilization safety studies, the epidemiological studies, and so on?
That's a very important question. Yeah, Diana.
It is, isn't it?
Yeah.
Because I think they work together. Having been involved in some of the PAS studies, you know, they're incredibly expensive, and it's difficult not only to recruit post-marketing for people who are taking whatever you're investigating, but then having the adequate number of controls and then following them over time. I think we need to be looking at a different way, or certainly how we actually involve both these PAS studies as well as some of the more interesting laboratory work that you can do with the changes that occur in individual women. But I still have my concerns that we always focus on the product and we're focusing on the progestin and perhaps even the estrogen, when we also need to be focusing on the women we prescribe to. And we've got some really fairly well-known safety guidance that we use now with the WHO medical eligibility criteria, and they've been modified for individual countries. And we've got to be aware that there are certain groups of women where combined hormonal contraception is still contraindicated, and independent risk factors of VTE such as obesity, age, strong family history of VTE is very important before we prescribe.
I agree. So as I mentioned before, we have this MEC or medical eligibility criteria, which for healthcare providers are or should be really well known. But then we have factors. So usually there are additional factors that may put women at risk, and factors that we tend to not think of, or we want to forget, is age and weight. So, I mean, those factors keep changing, and I think that's something we have to bear in mind.
And very often women will actually say, well, what is my personal risk factor? And we don't have a calculator, do we? You know, we can say for individual products, because they're clearly now within the labelling what potentially we think the risk factor of VTE is and what the background risk is. But for individual women, depending on their age, their family history, their BMI, their body mass index, it's really difficult.
Yes, I fully agree with you. In fact, you know, I worked for several years for the Belgium Medical Agency, and you know, a PAS is in fact part of the risk management plan for a novel combined oral contraceptive, and the PAS is conducted in order to assess the risk of VTE in real world user of these new combined oral contraceptives, as well for some of the protocols, as well as capturing data on the risk of atherothrombotic events. But however, there are limitations to this post-utilization safety study. For example, when we just look at the data from the PRE2 study, which aims at assessing the risk of VTE, the incidence of thromboembolic event was extremely low. I don't know if you remember, we are speaking about two cases of VTE events per 10,000 women year in the estradiol nomegestrol acetate arm, and approximately three cases of VTE per 10,000 women year in the etinyl estradiol levonorgestrel arm. So clearly there is some bias, because these data were not the same as the one we can capture usually in these studies and also in other epidemiological studies. So it means that there is bias. And as you mentioned, at the individual level, it's also important to be able, I think, to clearly provide a response to your patient. I'm not a treating physician. I'm a pharmacist, but you know, sometimes when I worked at the pharmacy, someone would say, "Okay, am I at risk of developing a VTE?" And except clinical data is the one you mentioned, you don't have a lot of choice. And I know that there was many biological investigations that have been done in the past in order to have a predictive marker of the risk of venous thromboembolism in users of combined hormonal contraceptive. Nevertheless, most of them failed for several reasons, including, for example, lack of sensitivity towards the biological changes that were induced by these hormonal therapies, and also the lack of specificity towards a prothrombotic condition, or even, and I think it was a pity, because I think we had a good test in at the end of the 90s, which was developed by Jan Rusing and his colleagues. But there was a problem of reproducibility between studies. And in fact, I think that tests that are able to assess, and it was proven that there is a link between the resistance towards the activated protein C, and tests that are sufficiently sensitive to see the difference between the different COC combination may better reflect the prothrombotic tendency of a particular hormonal contraceptive. And I don't know if you, in your practice, if you can have access to such kind of tests, if it can help you in your daily prescription habits.
Well, we don't have that kind of access. And I always remember... Not yet. Yes, well, that would be good. I mean, in days gone by, we used to do what we call sort of thrombogenic screening, and we were producing results. We didn't really know what it meant. And I think we were denying an awful lot of women combined hormonal contraceptives because of some spurious sort of results. And it would be really good to have some marker for women, along with their lifestyle issues, to be able to guide prescribing. But no, at the moment, we don't have very much to go on apart from their clinical history and their family history.
Yes. And in fact, it's true that yes, there was a lot of data and a lot of biological investigation were done on activated protein C. But most of the groups that were developing these tests failed in providing a reproducible assay able to give, you know, even for the development of new combined oral contraceptive, we need to have a test bench to compare the different combination of hormonal contraceptive and also to be able to assess what is the effect of a particular COC at the individual level. So maybe that if you are looking, I don't know if you are aware of that, but I was surprised when I was reading some EMA documents that in fact in 2005 they released a guidance in which you have a list of tests that need to be done in order to investigate the impact on hemostasis during the development of a new combined oral contraceptive. And in that list, you have two tests which focused on activated protein C resistance. And especially there is one very sensitive test, which is named the endogenous thrombin potential based APC resistant test. So the name is very long, but the test is very efficient in being able to detect a resistance towards activated protein C. And I think that we did a great job by validating this test, because now we can have this kind of test bench in order to compare the different COC. And in fact, it was very interesting also to develop this test, because as I mentioned in the beginning of my intervention, we were able to correlate this test, so the ETP-based APC resistant test, with the risk, the relative risk of VTE with the different combination. And the correlation was quite exceptional, because we have a correlation of 0.95, which is very high. And this is interesting, because when you are developing a new pill, then you can see just by investigating this test before having all these epidemiological studies. You know, as you mentioned, Diana, these epidemiological studies are quite expensive, but also they take a long time in order to get your results. And here, just by having biological investigations, you are able to see what you can expect from your combination. Obviously, it cannot replace the clinical data that you will gather from epidemiological studies, but at least it can provide you some reassurance that the pill has a very low impact on hemostasis.
So it would be really good with biomarker. I think so too. I mean, the tests that we have currently, we can use in special cases, but they are not enough specific. And also, I mean, what you hinted before, there is a problem with the epidemiological studies, that are many factors we can't control for, unknown factors and other influencing factors. And then we can't really do a randomized control trial, since this is such a rare condition. So a reliable, easy to use biomarker would, of course, be extremely good to use in addition to our clinical tools.
And would you see, Jonathan, that this is a test that would be used when you're developing combined hormonal contraceptives? Or do you ever see that it could be like a near patient test for individuals?
Yeah, it can be both. You can use it both. So basically, this test was, and we developed this test in our laboratory. And at the beginning, we developed it for the investigation during the development of a new combined oral contraceptive. But you can also use it as a marker for your patient. Especially, I think that we can capture unknown coagulopathy. So, you know, in the section 4.3, there is contraindication for these combined oral contraceptive. These are all the same, because the EMA decided some time ago to have the same label, practically the same label, at least the contraindications, and especially regarding the risk of VTE. And what is interesting is that they report that non-coagulopathy is a contraindication. But when you are thinking about the prevalence of factor V laden or prothrombin mutation, I'm not sure that all people that are carrying these genetic mutations have been detected. And such kind of test can be used as a screening test, at least to be able to detect factor V laden, prothrombin mutation, but also proteinase deficiency. So it can be useful as well at the individual level, but it is also sensitive to all the small changes that can occur when you are taking the pill. So they can also be useful for the development of a new combined oral contraceptive, but they are also interesting if you want to follow at the individual level what is the response of your patient, because you know you can have high or low responders to the hemostasis changes that are induced by combined hormonal contraceptive. So I really think that there is potential for this test, but clearly in the development, it helped to identify combinations that have very low impact on hemostasis, and especially on APC resistance, which is linked to the risk, the relative risk of VTE.
If we talk about factors related to increased risk for VTE, are there still many unknown factors, would you say?
Yes, probably, because, you know, sometimes I'm just speaking about global coagulation tests, such as the thrombin generation test. And you know, sometimes we don't have unidentified factors for very high thrombin generation in a patient. But you know that there is something in this patient. So there is a lot of genetic mutations that have been identified and which are linked to an increased risk of VTE. But obviously, there is also environmental impact that cannot be captured by genetic investigations. But the advantage of such kind of test is that it is a phenotypic, a functional assay. So it means that you capture your tendency to generate more thrombin, which is in fact the key effector in coagulation. And I really think that the development that have been done with the ETP-based APC resistance, and when you have, for example, a pill at the individual level, or generally when you are developing the pill, if you have a low impact on thrombin generation, it's certainly reassuring. Obviously, it's not clinical data, but as you mentioned, it's very difficult to be able to capture these events, or at least to design randomized controlled trial. I don't think it's possible, to be honest. And epidemiological studies have a lot of bias. So I think it's important to really provide reassurance that the pill that is currently prescribed to this or this patient is not impacting her hemostasis importantly. And this is what we've done in the phase 2 trial during the development of estetrol with drospirenone. You know, we compare estetrol with drospirenone, and we have two other comparators arms, which were with ethinyl estradiol in combination with levonorgestrel, or ethinyl estradiol in combination with drospirenone. And just focusing on the ETP-based APC resistance after 3 or 6 cycles, the change from baseline in the resistance towards activated protein C was around 30% with E4 in combination with drospirenone, while it was 165%, so more than fivefold higher, with ethinyl estradiol in association with levonorgestrel, and we have a change from baseline of 219%, so sevenfold higher in the ethinyl estradiol drospirenone arm. So it really means that you are able to see the difference, and we know that estetrol is a low impact on the liver, and this test is also able to reflect that. And this is interesting because it is also in correlation with other biomarkers that were used during the development of previous combined hormonal contraceptive. Because with estetrol in association with drospirenone, we have a very low impact on protein S. We have a low impact on prothrombin fragment 1-2, on TPA, and also on SHBG. And E4 drospirenone clearly has less impact on these biomarkers than ethinyl estradiol in association with levonorgestrel or in association with drospirenone.
I mean, this is really fascinating, isn't it? You know, starting to see some quite different results. And I suppose as a clinician, you're always tempted to say, oh, now this is going to be an ideal pill for perhaps the older woman, or somebody who's got a few more risk factors, or even people where you would be really quite worried about prescribing other combined hormonal contraceptives. But I think for the moment, haven't we got to play safe and stick with these newer pills for healthy women until we get more results?
I agree. That's extremely important, because otherwise we will actually destroy the future for the new and potentially safer pill. But we really need to have enough data before we can change our recommendations. So I think it's extremely important to follow the medical eligibility criteria for combined hormonal contraception.
No, and I fully agree with you. The aim is not to use such kind of product in women at risk because the contraindication are still there. But having considered all the other factors on efficacy and tolerability, if you know that you have a pill with a very low impact on key hemostatic factors, it means that at least on a biochemical point of view, it is safer than those who will clearly disturb the balance that is usually represented when we are speaking about hemostasis. So I really think it is also interesting to see that. And you know, it's something which I think, I don't remember that there is something in the literature clearly comparing the same progestin at the same dose with different estrogens. And here we have data, we have biological data, so I have to admit that it is only on approximately 30-35 patients, but in each group. But we are comparing E4 with drospirenone and EE with drospirenone, and by changing the estrogen, we clearly change the hemostatic profile of the combination. So clearly it also highlights in the same way that when we started to reduce the dose of 18-estradiol, we had a lower risk of VTE. Here again, we don't have yet epidemiological data on the E4 drospirenone group, even if gathering all the information from the phase 3 clinical trial development, we know that the risk is very low, but we need to have this post-authorization safety study before we can clearly say that the risk is lower. But even the biological data clearly demonstrate that if you change the estrogen, you change the impact on the liver, and probably that you also reduce the impact on hemostasis, and probably that you are generating a less prothrombotic environment compared to 18-estradiol in association with drospirenone. And this is important because the results we had are also for some biomarkers even lower than the one we had with 18-estradiol with levonorgestrel, which is considered as the gold standard by the European Medicine Agency.
I mean, this is fascinating. And can you explain why you think estradiol has that, sort of a different characteristic, I suppose, to certainly ethinyl estradiol and even estradiol?
Yes, regarding the pharmacology of E4, but it's not the scope of this podcast. Regarding the pharmacodynamic of E4, there is clearly different effects on nuclear and membrane estrogen receptor. So it means that it is clearly a different estrogen in its mode of action. And probably that the impact on the liver can be also explained by this different pharmacodynamic profile compared to 18-estradiol and estradiol. So obviously we are observing many very good data on hemostasis, and these markers are practically not impacted by E4 drospirenone compared to the other compound. And this makes sense when we look at the mode of action of estetrol, which is different from 18-estradiol and estradiol. So I really think that that here we have something which can be very good for the woman, at least for VTE and for the efficacy. To be honest, I've seen the results, and I'm not a clinician, and I'm not a prescribing clinician, and you can speak it better than me, you can explain it better than me, but I really think also that there is very good data on efficacy and safety.
Yes, and bleeding pattern, and of course, again, that's very important for compliance. So it's looking extremely interesting. I also had a question on the induced APC resistance. Can you see any difference in return to baseline between these different combinations with E4, E2, EE?
So in this phase 2 study, we did not follow, we did not monitor the woman for long-term evaluation. So we did not have access to a blood sampling when we stopped the pill. But what is interesting is that regarding the absolute value, when we compare to a normal population, so you know, the ETP-based APC resistance is usually expressed in a scale from 0 to 10, and the scale is named normalized activated protein C sensitivity ratio. And the closer you are to 1, the closer the lower you have a resistance towards activated protein C. And what is very, very interesting, it is that with E for drospirenone, we are very close to the normal range. So the normal range in this test was from 0 to 2.08. And with E for drospirenone, the median is at 2.09. So we are very close compared to etinylestradiol in combination with levonorgestrel, in which we can have NAPCSR quite above 3.5 and even higher than 4 for even higher than 4 for etinylestradiol in association with drospirenone. So we can expect that we have a so low impact that the risk probably is so low regarding ETP, regarding the resistance towards activated protein C, then I'm even not sure that thinking about when we can return to normal, we are already so close to the normal.
And I was just wondering, you probably haven't done it, but of course, we know there may be a drospirenone-only pill out there, and whether this sort of work's been done on that group of women.
Up to now, I have not yet tested. I have not tested the drospirenone only pill on the NAPCSR, but we can expect that there is very low impact, as we know, with the POC. Yeah, this needs to be investigated.
Yes, it would be fascinating to compare that to the results you already have. I know there'd be a different population of women, but you could almost say, well, maybe they're going to be very similar to those taking E4. And drospirenone.
Yes, clearly, probably that the impact will be, I will not say similar, because you know I always prefer to have the data before seeing anything. But we are already so close to the normal range with E4 in association with drospirenone that I'm not sure that we will be able to see a difference.
Well, I think we're all looking forward to this new pill coming onto the market.
Yes, looking very promising.
It is indeed.
And that brings us to the end of today's episode. A huge thanks to our three experts, Professor Christina Gemzel-Danielson, Dr. Diana Mansour, and Professor Jonathan Dufis, for sharing their insights. If you enjoyed today's discussion, be sure to check out our archive for more episodes just as interesting as this one. Also, make sure to subscribe wherever you get your podcast from. We release a new episode every Friday. Until next time, take care, stay safe, and goodbye for now.